This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Hello everyone, it's really nice to have you with us once again for the 55-minute edition of the program. Coming up today, we're going to bring you part one of our conversation with Andy Sennett, who for many years was the editor of the World Radio TV Handbook. He was also a contributor to Media Network on Radio Netherlands, and he was also the editor of the Media Network blog.
Radio RSA, which was once the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation, left the airwaves in the early 1990s to become Channel Africa. This change took place after the fall of the apartheid system in South Africa. Colin Miller was the head of the monitoring department of Radio RSA, and he'll be joining us to share his memories of working at the station.
We'll also have for you from the archives an edition of DX Corner from Radio RSA and much more.
This is Media Network Plus. Let's all join hands now and sing for the trees, the children, and make sure that Mother Nature loves us, and then we can all come together as one.
Oh, Brother Paulette, what a bunch of gobbledygook.
Hey, Keith, you wrote the script. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
BBC Worldwide, the commercial arm of the BBC, has secured a deal with Emirates to launch CBeebies. As the airline's first ever branded channel targeting children aged 6 and under. Loved by children and their carers the world over, CBeebies offers a range of high-quality programs which encourage the BBC's youngest audiences to learn through play in a constantly safe environment. From the 1st of November 2012, Emirates will feature a bespoke BBC's brand channel showing a select of longtime kids' favorites, like the award-winning Charlie and Lola and Nina and the Neurons. Leon Barco's book, News from the BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera, How the Three Broadcasters Cover the Middle East, offers a valuable insight into how the more powerful and social shape our views of the world through discourse and media. He reveals how BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera use cultural and religious signs to identify and begin and melend the Palestine-Israeli struggle and the Iraq invasion. Barco said the major problem facing Arab media is independence. If you are not independent, you could not produce impartial discourse. The coverage of the so-called Arab Spring, as he demonstrates this, is one-sided, partial, skewed, that sometimes is a shame to be associated with it. It has become more sectarian than the simple ordinance audiences on the street. It is disappointing to see major media that had established a name on the international scene towing the line of their financial sponsors. Some of the major media have dropped basic standards in vetting and verifying to the extent one no longer can distinguish between amateur and professional content. The Arab Spring seems to have destroyed the big names like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Deutsche Welle has signed an agreement with the United Nations expanding their cooperation. It is the latest development in a partnership set up 5 years ago. DW Director General Eric Bitterman and the United Nations Secretary General for Communications and Public Information, Peter Lansky Tafel signed the agreement on Monday at UN headquarters in New York. It's aimed at boosting cooperation in the field of media. Speaking for Deutsche Welle, Bitterman stressed that the promotion of human rights, participation and democratization is a central aspect of our multimedia programming in 30 languages, just as it is for the United Nations. Cooperation between Deutsche Welle and the United Nations is particularly important for us because it shares a sense of purpose. We would be glad to continue our work together in the future as well. DW's globalization magazine, Global 3000, broadcast in German, English, Spanish, and Arabic, is a prime example of this cooperation. DW has been able to include selected UN materials in their program, and in turn, United Nations television station, UNTV, has broadcast Global 3000 since the partnership was set up in 2007. And finally, Radio Australia will broadcast coverage of the AFL, that's the Australian Football League Grand Final, on Saturday, September 29th. It'll be part of their regular grandstand sports coverage. The coverage will be available on shortwave and local relays, but will not be available on Radio Australia's web stream due to content right limitations. The coverage will be as followed. South Pacific on 11945 and 15160 kHz. Southwest Pacific on 12080 and 15240 kHz. Papua New Guinea and West Pacific on 9660 kHz and 15415 kHz. Southeast Asia on 17750 kHz. For more information, you can check out their website, radioaustralia.com.au. And that's a look at some of the headlines happening in the world of media. A special thank you goes to Kim Andrew Elliott of the Kim Andrew Elliott blog. To find out more information about these and other stories, check them out at kimandrewelliott.com or go to our own website, www.pcjmedia.com, and you'll find a link for them at the bottom of the page. I'm Keith Pahol.
For those who have been listening to this program for some time, you may recall that for a long time we used to take our news items from the Media Network blog. This blog was compiled and edited by Andy Sennett, who at one time had also been the editor of the World Radio TV Handbook. Since Radio Netherlands was hit by a large budget cut earlier this year, Andy decided to retire from Radio Netherlands. Andy's career goes back even before Radio Netherlands. In the early 1970s, he spent some time at BBC Monitoring in Reading. Today, we bring you part one of our conversation with Andy Sennett.
My grandfather had given my parents a radio for their wedding and when they got married. And this radio was supposed to receive long and medium wave, but due to a faulty wave chain switch, it could only receive long wave. And my mother was quite happy with that because in those days, BBC, the old light program was on long wave, so she listened to that all day. But I discovered there was another thing on long wave, and that was the Voice of America relay station in Munich. And I found that, and I found it very interesting because, you know, American voices. And of course, initially, I didn't know it was, you know, I thought I'd picked up America. And so that got me really interested. And indeed, I was around that sort of age, 9 or 10 years old, I guess.
So you discovered it from long wave listening. How did that go into shortwave? Or was that just the obvious next step and you decided to get a better radio? And you're like, oh, what does this do? And you have all the countries, you know, Germany, Finland, Sweden, Australia.
Yes, exactly. I, you know, realized from listening to the VOA that they had other transmissions which I couldn't pick up. And I'd also, the other thing is, my grandfather had been very keen on radio himself and it was actually, you know, repaired radios for people. And I remember the first radio station I ever heard on shortwave in his shed in the bottom of the garden was Radio Canada International. So I knew there were all these things out there. So I, you know, kept persuading my father I wanted a radio that could pick up shortwave. So I think we bought an old mains radio from somewhere, and that's how I got started.
So it actually seems like I'm actually on the right track, because everybody that I've asked that question to have exactly the same story. I mean, it's so different from, let's say, you know, people that just say discover television or film or other mediums. I mean, with international broadcasting, that seems to be the way people did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people discovered international broadcasting by accident. I mean, the war, obviously later I went to work for the World Radio TV Handbook, but I'd never heard of it then. And, you know, I had no idea how to find information about broadcasters. I hadn't heard of DXing or DX clubs or anything like that. So, you know, it was a learning curve and learning by listening.
Now, back then when you got your first receiver and you started to listen, what sort of things would you listen to? I mean, you just said that one of the first stations you heard was Radio Canada International, or as it was called then, the CBC International Service. What were some of the other ones you remember?
Well, even on medium wave, there were quite a few in those days. There was Radio Berlin International from East Germany. There was Radio Prague. And Radio Budapest in Hungary also had a medium wave transmission on a week, Friday night, I think it was, a live transmission in English. And, you know, I gradually got to know those stations and then heard details of their shortwave programs via the medium wave. So then I tried to find them on shortwave. Of course, it wasn't easy because these old sets didn't have exact frequency readout. You know, I had to just twiddle the dial a few times until I found them.
You know what's interesting, Andy, and, you know, for the years that I've been listening, there are two major events that stick out in my memory that I learned from listening to international shortwave broadcasting. One of them was the release of Nelson Mandela on Radio RSA, the Voice of South Africa. And the second one would be June 4th, 1989, with what happened in Tiananmen Square. And I tell people, younger people that is, you know, I heard this from the radio because the internet was, well, practically non-existent. CNN was around at the time, but their international news coverage, well, was very slim. It was mainly focused on the United States. I mean, this was the main way to get international news, to get it quick, because newspapers, if something happened, let's say, in Beijing on a Thursday, it wouldn't be reported in a newspaper until a Friday night or Saturday in North America.
No, I had the same experience. I mean, I remember when President Kennedy was assassinated, my mother came into my bedroom. I was 13 at the time. And my first instinct was, oh, I better tune to the Voice of America. And I actually heard the Voice of America announce that President Lyndon B. Johnson is the new President of the United States. And a few minutes later, they had to retract it, saying, oh, we understand the reports that President Kennedy had died were premature and have not been confirmed. So they actually announced, I mean, he had actually died by then, but they announced it too early. And I don't think they would make that mistake these days, because there are a lot more ways of finding things out. And the other big event that I remember from my early listening was in 1968 when the Russians went into Czechoslovakia. And I remember listening to the two Radio Prague's, the Radio Prague that was taken over by the Russians and the Radio Free Prague, which was broadcasting, I understand, from, I think it was from Bratislava. And they were still broadcasting programs talking about the Prague Spring, which of course very quickly, within a few days, came to an end.
It is quite interesting, you know, when you think back that at the time, getting news this immediate, this quick was a rarity. I mean, Danny, even television couldn't report on a lot of these news stories as quick as radio did.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I did have a personal experience of that. I went to work at BBC Monitoring after I finished at university. And during my time there, I was just coming to the end of night shift, and I noticed that the Voice of Nigeria hadn't broadcast the news. And I told my colleague who was coming to take over for the day shift, please make sure you record the next news bulletin, because the last one didn't air. And I figured, you know, I had a hunch that something was going on, and 1 minute past the hour, I suddenly heard him call coup in Nigeria. And in fact, the Voice of Nigeria was the first source of information to the outside world that there had been a coup there. The airport was closed, everything was closed, and the first announcement was on the Voice of Nigeria shortwave service.
A story that Vasily Strelnikov told me once that when I talked to him recently, we talked about it again because it was so funny. When he started at Radio Moscow, one of his jobs was reading continuity and reading news bulletins on the hour and half hour. And he said back in those days, the news on the hour had to be exactly so many minutes right down to the last second. And he said what would happen is because certain presenters would read faster or slower than others, if you read faster, you would take the first story from a news bulletin from 2 years from the 2 hours ago and reread that one. And he told me about this one time. He was on news shift on a Saturday, and he was a fast reader, so this he kept reading the same story over and over and over, and it was about a literary conference that was taking place in Moscow. And he told me later he found out that BBC Monitoring had been listening to this same story over and over and over and actually notified the Foreign Office in the UK thinking that it was some type of code.
that did actually used to happen. We had to report, they call it a station behavior at BBC Monitoring, and they still do that. Anything unusual is... monitored very carefully because, it could be indicative of something going on. Another thing they do is that they used to listen during the Cold War to all the reports of official meetings and ceremonies and so on, and note carefully the order in which names of different officials were read out. And if somebody went up the list, they were doing well. Somebody went down the list, they were probably heading for the... the Far East or something. In those days, a lot of information was passed to the Foreign Office from monitoring ordinary public radio broadcasts.
Now, the time that you were at BBC Monitoring, how did it work? Did you have they say, here's a couple of radios, here's some headphones, here's some tape machines, go to work?
Well, I was actually an operational assistant, and that my job was to make sure that the monitors in the different languages received the right station at the right time and the right place, because we had if you can imagine a big board with jack sockets and jack cords and plugs and so on, and we had to make sure that stuff was... We had a receiving station several miles away with special antennas and very good receivers and so on, and the more difficult stations were picked up there and then fed to us online. And then we had to make sure that what we received was passed on to the monitor in the correct place, so he was listening to the right thing. And in addition to live programs, we also record, some of them which were considered less important were recorded and listened to later.
Now, when you worked at BBC Monitoring, let's say programs that went out live or the ones that were recorded, what would happen after to the tapes? Would they just be archived or would they be erased and used for something else?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think there was a procedure by which somebody would decide what should be kept and what can be archived. Each broadcast had a different level of importance, so it might be the very important broadcasters would be texted in full, so the entire text would be produced. Some broadcasts would be summarized, and that required obviously some editorial, some knowledge of the country concerned. And others maybe just they would simply write the headlines of news items. And then if somebody, yes, they would certainly the audio would be kept for a certain time. So if anybody in London requested further details of a particular item, this could be done for them.
How long did you stay with BBC Monitoring?
Just 4 years.
Your next step after that, was that with the World Radio TV Handbook?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I had envisaged staying a lot longer than I did, but simply somebody said that there was an advertisement in Shortwave Magazine, which was mainly for radio amateurs in the UK, from Jens Frost, who was the editor of the WRTH, and he was looking for an assistant. And just a few months earlier, a colleague of mine, who was only a few years older than me, had been promoted to chief monitor in my section. So I knew that my chances of promotion You know, it's going to take a long time before I could be promoted to a more senior position. So I decided to have a go at the WRTH job, and I gather that because it was in a relatively obscure place, most broadcast listeners didn't see it. You know, I was the only person who applied.
I mean, up until that point, did you also consider, say, working as a broadcaster, or had you also worked as a broadcaster during that time?
No, well, as you can hear, Keith, I don't have a good radio voice. My diction is not perfect. I mean, these things can be coached, but I prefer to be working behind the scenes. My broadcasting career, such as it was, came a little later when I joined Radio Netherlands as a freelance.
How long you were with the World Radio TV Handbook?
19 years altogether. I was I went to Denmark in 1978. Jens Frost retired in 1987. And then I moved to take over as editor-in-chief in Amsterdam in 1987 and had another 10 editions under my control.
Now, from that point, when you were at the World Radio TV Handbook, to when you started listening for the very first time to Radio Canada International, what were some of the major changes that took place during that time in international broadcasting? I'm not talking about, let's say, changes politically in many countries around the world, but let's say from a listening standpoint, or had shortwave from when you started listening to the World Radio TV Handbook, had it just been the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think the crucial point was the end of the Cold War. Up until then, a lot of broadcasters, you know, year by year, you've got the same programs at the same times every week, with the same presenters, and often, you know, mailbag programs with letters from the same listeners, and they basically just carried on because the Cold War was on, and nobody saw fit to to get out of international broadcasting. Once this had happened, and Germany had been reunified, and the Soviet states had become independent, the whole reason for a lot of these stations being on the air was started being called into question by politicians. You know, do we really need to broadcast in so many languages and so on? And so with that, the kind of programming of the languages that they decided to keep also changed. And in many cases became a lot more informal, but possibly from a politician's point of view, a lot less relevant to what they thought politicians should be approving.
You know, because we've seen, like, you know, since the Cold War ended, a lot of stations, and I would put them in the category of these small to medium-sized broadcasters, stations like YOE Radio Finland, Radio Norway, Radio Denmark, and a number of other ones, just sort of vanish into thin air. It seems that the larger and more powerful ones are around today, but international broadcasting, Andy, around that time, what was the mood in it? Because, you know, when I speak to some people like Bob Zanotti or Ian McFarland, they all tell me that at that time, people were starting to say, what do we do now?
Yeah, exactly. When I joined the WRTH, I started going around to visit various broadcasters, and I found the morale was generally quite low. And quite a lot of people had been there since, you know, for 20, 30 years, and they were sort of just looking to see how many more years they had to work until they could retire. And there wasn't a great deal of motivation to come up with new ideas and produce better programs. The only motivation was to convince the people who funded them that they should continue to be funded, and, you know, until it was time for them to retire.
Do you think, let's say, international broadcasting as it is today, or as it was then, would have fared better over the last, say, 20, 25 years if, after the Cold War, broadcasters said, okay, look, things have changed, we have to change with the times and do something different to keep an audience? Because from what I've seen, a lot of people just sat around for many years, and then when government said, oh, we're going to cut you, they went, huh, why?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, as I said, a lot of people had been in the business for so long. And when you're in just one business and you're not taking a wider perspective, you kind of get into a rut and you don't really realize how the world around you has changed. And I think a lot of the things that the stations were putting out, although they just kept regurgitating the same you know, kind of format and the same content, it was becoming less and less relevant to the people who, you know, were, they hoped would tune in, and particularly young people. And it was mainly the audiences for international broadcasting in the last 20 years. The average age has got older and older. And, you know, if you look at some of the forums now for people who discuss international broadcasting, it's like an edition of the British sitcom Grumpy Old Men.
But, you know, it really is, Andy, you know, depending on region. I mean, if I take East Asia and Southeast Asia and the Pacific, the listeners tend to be a lot younger than, let's say, listeners in North America or in Europe.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I was mainly referring to Europe and North America, where, you know, the shortwave audience has shrunk to a very, very low amount compared with what it was 10 years ago. But certainly in parts of Asia and in Africa, you know, shortwave in many countries is still very important. And I think the problem that some broadcasters have had is that they haven't done enough research. I was, in the last few years, involved in a strategy at Radio Netherlands where we actually looked at the situation in each country. And what we found was that the situation, for example, in Africa, countries may be neighboring countries, but they had totally different media landscape. You know, for example, in Nigeria, just about everybody has a mobile phone, whereas there are still some African countries where mobile phones are by no means ubiquitous. And so you have to employ different strategies to reach people in those different environments.
But yet, Andy, you know, some international broadcasters during that transition period fared very well. I mean, for example, Radio Netherlands, after 1992, 1993, started to make major changes in the way they did programs and their presentation and everything, and remained relevant. But some other broadcasters, I can think of one right now, Deutsche Welle, didn't change at all and really didn't start to change until a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't speak for other broadcasters, but certainly at Radio Netherlands, I guess we were unusual in that we had some very highly motivated people on the staff. And, you know, they were very careful about who they hired, and they would make sure that somebody was really, really genuinely interested in, you know, they weren't just going there to find a cushy job. And the result was that you know, we would constantly discuss amongst ourselves whether we were doing the right thing, how things were going, whether we should be doing something different. And there was always plenty of new ideas coming along. And I'm not sure that was the case at all the other broadcasters. But as I say, I'm not really in a position, since I haven't worked there, to comment on that.
After you left World Radio TV Handbook, was this the time, or did you take some time off before you went to Radio Netherlands?
Well, I probably would have done. I mean, I actually, Bart Kapiras, my associate editor, and I both decided to leave at the same time. I won't go into the details why, but we had problems with the publisher. I expected to be probably unemployed for quite a few months before finding some other employment. But because I had been freelancing since 1981 with media news from the WRTH on Media Network, I knew Deanna Jansen very well, who was obviously the co-host of the program at the time. And within a few weeks, I got a call from her saying, you know, we need somebody to come and work for our new internet department. Would you like to come along and we'll talk about it? So I got, if you like, headhunted. I jokingly say headhunted, but of course, I wasn't really doing anything. They didn't have to do much hunting to find me.
So it was. It sounds like it was almost just by accident. You just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and everything was like a perfect storm.
Yes, precisely. And not only that, but because I had been going to Radio Netherlands since I moved to Amsterdam in 1987, and, you know, I'd been going up to do my monthly contribution in Hilversum, so I got to meet some of the other presenters, people like Pete Myers, who was fondly remembered by everybody who worked with him. So I felt I was going to join friends. So it wasn't really like starting a new job. It was just like, going back home almost.
How many years did you spend at Radio Netherlands?
Well, believe it or not, the unlucky 13, I guess. Because in exactly 15, if you count, because I started as a freelance, then I got a part-time contract. My full-time contract started 1st of January 1999. So indeed, that's just a little over 13 years.
It's been a few months now, Andy, that you haven't worked for Radio Netherlands. You took early retirement because of a massive budget cut that affected the station. The time that you've had off, I mean, did you say to yourself, you know, I would have liked to have stayed on for another few years?
Well, I think possibly, I mean, the way my mind had been working, I wanted to have a bit of a break because I was doing this media network weblog, and it was basically 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. I got very little time off. I think I only had two Christmas holidays in that time. I did take time away from the office because I had to, you know, because of the terms of the contract and so on. But, you know, I simply sat at home and worked in my home office. So I was actually producing the same amount of material for the public as I was, you know, when I was in the office in Hilversum. So I really needed a break. But I think I probably would have decided to go part-time had the job still been there.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus, the 55-minute edition from PCJ Radio. Now, just imagine at this very moment you had what you would call, let's say, a time-traveling radio, and you put the year, I don't know, one year off the top of my head, 1981, and you tuned in to Radio RSA, and you heard their very distinctive interval signal. Now, I know that many SWLs out there remember that signal because it was something that you can sort of whistle or hum to. But do you know the story behind it? Well, here's a little explanation that was recorded by the head of the English service about that interval signal.
Radio RSA, the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation, broadcasts in English, French, German, Dutch, Portuguese, and Afrikaans, and in the African languages Swahili, Chichewa, Lozi, and Tsonga. The interval or identification signal used by the service is a montage of the call of a South African bird, the bokmakiri, a member of the shrike family, and a South African folk song played on a guitar. The Afrikaans title of the tune is Ver in die Wereld Kitty, which could be translated as Far, Far Away in the Wide, Wide World, Kitty. Here is a recording of Radio RSA's identification signal which precedes every transmission.
This is Radio RSA, the voice of South Africa from Johannesburg.
Thank you.
That was the identification signal of Radio RSA, the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation.
Yes, the interval signal from Radio RSA, the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Well, not too long ago, I received an email from a gentleman by the name of Colin Miller. He's a regular listener to many of the programs here at PCJ. Well, Colin informed me, to my delight, that he used to work for Radio RSA in the 1980s in the monitoring section, meaning if you sent in a reception report, they would respond and check out what reception was like in various parts of the world. I said to him, well, you know what, we have to have you on the program to talk about what it was like working at Radio RSA. So we called him up and we spoke over Skype.
Well, I was in charge of the monitoring panel at Radio RSA. They had about 500, maybe 400 to 500 monitors all over the world who sent in regular reception reports. And we weren't actually in the building that Radio RSA is at. Yeah, we were actually out at Honeydew, which is about 10 miles, 15 kilometers out of town. And they had a receiving station there. And part of our duties were to do the frequency planning and the analyzing of the reception reports that we got from monitors. So I was in charge of that for a number of years.
Now, I'm really curious because you were getting all these letters from around the world, and South Africa, like, say, Australia, is really far from many places. I mean, what was your reaction when you would sit there and you'd get these letters from Southeast Asia, Asia, the Pacific, North America, Europe? Were you kind of looking at this going, this is amazing. It's just amazing. You know, I'm sitting here and people are listening to our programs in far off lands.
Yeah, well, back then it was amazing. Of course, now I wish that we'd had the technology back then that we have now, because you know, when somebody sent us a reception report, it would take a couple of weeks to get to us, and then we'd have to process it and send them a QSL card or whatever and respond. And of course, now you can do it virtually online and you know, through email.
Somebody told me a joke one time. He said, oh, yeah, the days when we were to get the reception reports from our monitors and even listeners, it would take 3 weeks for us to get. There was the turnaround time and then getting out the QSL card. He said by the time we would get everything out back out to them, the new schedule, the fall schedule, had already started.
That's right. Yeah, so yeah, if a couple of people did send us or did call us, you know, on the phone to give us an update. If there was a conflict with another station on the same frequency, they would call us and we would they would advise an alternate frequency and we would do it that way.
Now, Radio RSA, when it was on air, how many frequencies would they use, let's say, at one time? Were they, let's say, like Radio Netherlands, where they could use maybe three or four frequencies targeting one specific area, or would they just use one?
Oh, no. Well, we had, we had four 250-kilowatt transmitters, and I think we were using one 100-kilowatt and the 3 500-kilowatts. What's that, eight? We could work on eight frequencies theoretically at the same time, you know, broadcasting more than one program, of course. Our busy time would have been the early evening around 1600, 1700 UTC.
And were these all transmissions from Meyerton?
Yeah, they all came from Meyerton. And actually, there are two sites at Meyerton. There's a Meyerton, the main shortwave international site with the big transmitters. And then there's a domestic one about a mile or 1.5 kilometers away. That's just the 100-kilowatt transmitter. Like, they relay the BBC and a few other stations as well for people in nearby countries.
How did you end up at Radio RSA? Were you looking for a job and just kind of walked in and you were at the right place at the right time? Or did you have any prior interest to work in radio?
Well, I had been working for many years at what they call a building society, which is a financial institution that's kind of like a mortgage corporation. And a job there was kind of monotonous and no prospects for promotion, etc. And I had, of course, for many years been a shortwave listener and gained a lot of experience in listening to shortwave. And Pete Martins, who was in charge at Panorama, he knew about me, and we had known each other for a number of years, and he gave me an opportunity to join them at Panorama. You know, I sent in an application and I was accepted on the basis of my knowledge of shortwave and able to help the monitors there at the station. You know, they would sometimes not know what station they were listening to, and they might need a bit of assistance from someone, and I was able to help them identify some of the difficult to identify stations.
So listening to shortwave, was this something that you had done from an early age? I mean, when you were growing up in South Africa, was it quite common for people, let's say, to listen to the BBC World Service or the Voice of America and other international broadcasters?
Well, there was a shortwave club that started in 1961. Before that, there was no organized DXing community in South Africa. I guess everybody just listened when they, you know, to shortwave, like you say, the BBC or Voice of America and AFRTS and a few other stations too. But after arriving in South Africa in the late 40s, I met a radio ham, and that sparked my interest in radio and shortwave. And then my parents bought me a little Siemens shortwave radio for my birthday 1 year, and I started tuning around on that. It was only around 1959, I think it was, that I really got interested in shortwave. One night I was listening, tuning around the dial, and I heard a strong station. There was they're broadcasting in English. And at first I thought it was the BBC, and after a while it became apparent that it was actually Lisbon in Portugal, Emissora Nacional in Portugal. And then a little bit later in the evening, I heard another station. I forget now, I think it was Radio Sweden or Switzerland, something like that. And I thought to myself, well, I wonder how many other stations are broadcasting in English. So that's how my interest in DXing started, really seriously.
Now, at that time, in Africa, across Africa, was Radio South Africa the, if I can express it this way, the main international broadcaster from Africa, or one of the only ones with such far a reach?
Well, actually, you should distinguish from Radio South Africa and Radio RSA. Radio South Africa was actually one of the internal domestic services. And Radio RSA, actually RSA stands for Republic of South Africa. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. But yes, there were a few other international stations. I think of Radio Cairo. And then there was ETLF, the Radio Voice of the Gospel, which was run by the Lutheran World Fellowship out of Ethiopia. And what else? There may have been a couple of Voice of America, of course, from Monrovia, Liberia. And those were pretty much the main ones broadcasting internationally.
The time that you were there, did you have any opportunity or any chances to do any programming?
Yes, I did do a few programs. I remember that New Year's Eve was a big thing back then, we did a special live show from midnight local time, which would be, 2200 UTC, until 0300 the next morning on the New Year's Day. And I used to go in, and Pete Martins would be there, and some of the other announcers. And we would take calls from listeners wishing us the best for the new year. Of course, we'd play music and have interviews with other people. And that was quite a popular program. And then also, occasionally, I would help Pete Martins with the DX Corner program be a co-host. So, yeah, that was my about as much of the broadcasting that I did. I wasn't a professional broadcaster.
Colin, thank you very much for taking some time out to talk to us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you, Keith. It's been a real pleasure talking to you as well. And I hope all the listeners found the program interesting. And so you all take care.
That was my little conversation with Colin Miller. Now, during the interview, Colin mentioned that from time to time, he would appear on the DX Corner, which was a program that aired on Radio RSA. Well, we now have an edition recorded in 1986, which was the final edition that he did for the station before leaving South Africa for Canada.
Hello, DX friends. I'm Pete Martins, and with me in the studio today we have Kathy Fitch. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
And also Colin Miller. Hello, Colin.
Hello, Peter.
Colin has been with Radio RSA for some years and will be leaving to settle in Canada, so we'll discuss this later on in the program.
We have also invited the chairman of the South African Radio League, Johannesburg branch, Hans van der Groenendaal, to participate in future DX Corner programs. Hans is also involved with amateur satellite activities, so we have Hans standing by with his contribution.
Well, friends, I'd just like to correct something what Hans said there. The program Amateur Radio Mirror is actually broadcast at over 800 UTC on Sundays, not 0900. And Kathy, you got that QSL card in front of you, the ZS6JCF. It's quite a nice card, isn't it?
It's a very attractive card. It's got a sort of outline of the Johannesburg skyline, showing the tower and all the large buildings. And as it's only on the air until the end of this year, this was obviously going to be a future collector's item, Colin.
That's right, it is.
So, there you are. You just jolly well listen out for this and write in as soon as you can to get one of these, what was obviously going to be a rare item in the future.
Colin, you started out with the hobby of DXing at a very early age, and through your DX experiences eventually became what I might term a shortwave monitoring specialist. Then you joined Radio RSA in the monitoring panel section, where you've become very much a central figure with our monitoring panel members. And also some years ago you qualified as radio amateur ZS6BYL.
Colin, why this decision to leave South Africa for Canada?
Well, it was family reasons, really. You may know last year I lost my father, and at the moment it's just me and my mother who are living in South Africa, who are members of our family, and all our relations are overseas. And we felt that we should emigrate, and my brother invited us to stay with him in Sarnia, which is a place about 200 miles from Toronto.
And are you going to continue your DX activities in Canada?
Yes, well, I'm hoping to join a few DX clubs over there and possibly branch out into medium wave DXing. I have a great deal of interest in medium wave stations, and there are probably over 4,000 or 5,000 in North America alone, so I think I have plenty to listen to.
And obviously amateur radio, I suppose, as well.
Oh, yes. Well, I will be still interested in amateur radio over there.
Colin, do you have a message for your monitoring panel members?
Well, yes. I probably won't have time to say everything I want to. I might leave something out, but it's most gratifying to, when I'm listening to different stations to hear the names of some of our monitors mentioned on their programs. And I'll miss the friendship that I've gained over the years. I've enjoyed being with the panel. And, I'll be unable to reply to every letter that I've received, but rest assured my wishes are with everybody, and I hope possibly to meet some of our Canadian and USA monitors when I move over there, and possibly even at one of the ANARC conventions in the future.
Well, Colin, on behalf of all the staff of Radio RSA, I want to thank you for your devoted assistance over the years, and needless to say, we're going to definitely miss you, and like to take this opportunity to wish you and your mum, on behalf of us all, a very pleasant trip and the best of success for the future.
Thanks. Colin, all the best. Thanks very much, and all the best to everybody.
Well, that winds up this program, Kathy.
Yep.
So from me, Pete Martins, good DX and 73s.
And from me, Kathy Fitch, good DX and Totsians. Colin?
Yes, Totsians, and all the best.
DX Corner from Radio RSA from 1986, going back in time. Paulette?
And up next is Dan Hensley with our propagation report.
Here's propagation for the week from September 29th to October 5th, 2012. On September 29th, the 10.7 centimeter flux starts out at 150, dropping 5 points on September 30th to become 145. On October 1st, dropping 5 more points to become 140, and yet another 5-point drop on October 2nd to bring the 10.7 centimeter flux to 135. From October 3rd to October 5th, a steady 10.7 centimeter flux at 130. The A index will be 5 from September 29th to October 2nd, spiking at a high level of 10 on October 3rd, and then remaining high on October 4th and 5th at a level of 8. The KP index will be 2 for the first 4 days of this week from September 29th to October 2nd. From October 3rd to October 5th, a KP index of 3. We see the return of sunspots this week en masse. Sunspot 1573 is rotating out of view, bringing sunspots 1575 through 1580 into view. We should see some extra D-layer absorption happening October 3rd through the 5th, with the A index being so high on those days. The solar wind blowing around Earth is thin and steady, which means it is doing little to rattle our planet's magnetic field. A far-side sunspot that exploded and hurled a bright CME into space on September 23rd is now rotating onto the Earth's side of the sun. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory photographed the emerging blast site during the early hours of September 26th. Because the sunspot is still near the sun's eastern horizon, foreshortening prevents a clear view of its core magnetic structure. The events of September 23rd, however, suggest that this could be a potent active region. Stay tuned for updates as a sunspot turns toward Earth.
And if you'd like to listen to this program again or any other past editions of Media Network Plus, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus.
And while you're at the website, you'll also find the transmission schedule for the World Radio Network, because there's also the weekly 30-minute edition, which includes, of course, the 55-minute edition. Anyway, just go to the website that Paula just mentioned, and you'll see everything there. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. Paulette, before we go, I have a little question for you.
Uh-oh.
No. It's not that kind of question. I'm not going to ask you about what kind of ladies' underwear you wear. I promise. I'm not going to do that.
Thank you. I'm not going to tell you.
It's okay. We have the pictures. We'll put them on our Facebook page. No,
I might tell you what kind of men's underwear I wear, though.
I'm not even going to go there. I'm just not going to go there. No, the question I had is, do you know the name Jim Reeves?
Absolutely.
He was nicknamed the gentleman of country music. Gentleman of country music, and left this world way too young in a plane crash in the early 1960s. Well, since today on the program, we talked a little bit about Radio RSA from South Africa. Did you know that Jim Reeves was a major superstar in South Africa? In fact, he was so big, he made a couple of films there. He would go there for concerts, and he recorded albums in Afrikaans.
I had absolutely no idea of that, Keith. And in fact, I wonder how many Jim Reeves fans on this continent actually know that.
Well, what we're going to do for any Jim Reeves fans out there who didn't know that Jim Reeves sang in Afrikaans, we're going to listen to a song called The Old Kalahari that he sings in Afrikaans and English. So on behalf of myself, Keith Parent in Taipei, Taiwan,
and Paulette Macquarie in Vancouver, Canada,
73s to you all,
and 88s to the ladies.
There in the old Kalahari, dar soon be Burasu. Yeah, on's the old Kalahari, the old Kalahari boom. Endless the plains all around me, the burning sun and sand, lovely and peaceful surroundings, my old Kalahari land. Song be sesun on your bosu, di hatu gu song to first smile, Roy African de Rossi, senior. Old Kalahari will be part of that land.